She shielded the exiled cub from the flood with her body, not knowing. He bore the king's mark. There was an old saying in the valley settlements below the Ashvorn Mountains, passed from grandmother to daughter like a bruise that never quite healed. A wolf without a pack is a ghost. A ghost cannot save anyone. Maren Voss had heard it 100 times. She had believed it once, the way children believe anything they are told with enough certainty. She was wolfless, born to a pack mother but arriving in the world without the second heartbeat inside her chest, that warm animal pulse that the others wore like a birthright. The pack had kept her on because her mother had been loved. Then her mother had died, and keeping Maren on became a habit no one wanted to examine too closely, because to examine it would mean deciding, and deciding would require courage no one there seemed to have. She was 23 when the flood came. She was standing at the edge of the river with wet boots and a borrowed lantern, and she did not yet know that the thing she was about to do would tear that old saying open like paper. Ghosts, it turned out, could save everything. Chapter 1. The Edge of the Ashvorn. The Vithara River came down from the mountains without warning in the way that only rivers and ruin can, as if they had been planning it all along and simply hadn't told you. Maren was there because she was always sent where no one else wanted to go. The outer levee needed checking after 3 days of rain, and Garrett, the pack's overseer of grounds, had looked around the longhouse hall at every able-bodied wolf in attendance, and then looked at Maren, who was mending a basket in the corner, and said her name the way people say a word they already know means nothing will cost them. She'd taken the lantern. She'd taken her waterproof coat, which was not very waterproof. She'd walked the 2 miles to the levee in the dark and the drizzle, and she'd seen at once that the berm was cracking, a long diagonal split in the earthwork, weeping brown water at the seam, the river pressing behind it with the slow confidence of something that has already won. She was turning back to run for the settlement when she heard the sound. It was small. Beneath the roar of the river and the percussion of rain on stones, it was almost nothing. A thin, reedy cry, like a bird caught under eaves. But Maren had spent 23 years listening carefully to things others dismissed, and she stopped. There, jammed against the crumbling downriver post of the levee gate, was a child. He looked perhaps 4 years old. He was soaked to the skin and shaking, clinging to the post with both arms wrapped around it, his small face turned up against the rain. Around his left wrist was a copper cuff, sized for a child, engraved with markings Maren could not read in the bad light. He wore clothes that were too fine for this valley. Wool dyed deep blue, silver buttons. Someone's treasured child, then. Someone had dressed him with care. The crack in the levee groaned. A chunk of earthwork the size of a hay bale sloughed away into the current. Maren ran. Chapter 2. The Breaking. She reached him in the seconds she had left, and there were not many of them. The post he clung to was already listing, the ground beneath it dissolving into the river's hunger. She grabbed him around the waist, and he screamed. Not from fear of her, she realized, but from the effort of letting go, because letting go meant trusting someone, and he did not know yet whether she was worth trusting. "I have you," she said against his ear, over the water. "I have you. I have you." The levee broke. It did not break loudly the way a wall breaks. It broke silently, in the way of surrender. And then the water was everywhere, waist high and ice cold and fast, the kind of current that gets under your feet and argues with your bones. Maren staggered. She would fall. She knew she would fall, and she could not fall, because she had the child. She turned her body. Upstream. She put her back to the current and her arms around the boy, and she held on to a length of levee fencing with both fists, the rusted wire cutting her palms, and she became the thing between him and the river. The flood pushed. She pushed back. Later, she would not be able to say how long it lasted. Long enough for the cold to move from her skin into her chest. Long enough for the child to stop screaming and press his face into her neck and go very still in the way that children go still when they have decided to trust entirely and hold nothing in reserve. She felt his small heartbeat against her collarbone, fast and bright and wolf-warm, even in all that cold water, and she thought, "He's alive. Keep him alive." The water receded. Not all at once. The river doesn't give back what it takes in a gracious gesture. It gives it back in increments, grudgingly, an inch at a time, until Marin was standing in mud to her shins, and the night was quiet, except for the drip of everything and the boy's unsteady breathing. She looked down at him. He looked up at her. His eyes were an unusual color, a very dark amber, almost copper, lit from inside with something she could not name. He had mud on his cheek and a cut on his chin, small and already clotting. The copper cuff on his wrist caught the lantern light. The lantern had survived somehow, wedged against the post and still burning, a minor miracle she chose not to question. She lifted it closer to read the markings on the cuff. The symbols were not Valley Pack script. They were old, formal, the language of the mountain packs that governed from Ashvorn Keep. She could make out only one word, because it was the same in every dialect. Sorin. His name, she assumed. She smiled at him. "Sorin," she said. "I'm Marin. Can you walk?" He considered this with extreme seriousness, then nodded once. Chapter 3. The Longhouse. She carried him anyway. He was trembling too hard for walking, and she was not much better, but she was bigger, and she had adrenaline still burning under her skin like a slow coal. She took the long way around, away from where the river had spilled, and by the time she reached the settlement's edge, the rain had softened to mist. The longhouse was lit. Someone had already seen the flood from higher ground and raised the alarm, and now the hall was full of pack members in various states of emergency, voices overlapping, the smell of wet fur and pine smoke, Garrett standing at the center of it looking importantly alarmed. The room went quiet when Marin walked in. She was bleeding from her palms. She was soaked through. She was holding a child no one recognized. Garrett looked at the boy the way he looked at most things that required a decision. Then he looked at the copper cuff. His expression changed. "Where did you find him?" "The levee." She set Sorin down, but kept one hand on his shoulder. "He was trapped against the gatepost. The levee is broken. The eastern section is gone." "Yes, we know about the levee." Garrett hadn't moved. "That cuff, that's a mountain pack mark." "I know." "Those markings, that's not just any mountain pack." He lowered his voice, which in a crowded longhouse accomplished nothing except making everyone pay closer attention. "That's a royal marking. I've seen it once on documents from Ashvorn Keep." The word royal passed through the hall like a stone through still water. Marin felt Sorin press slightly closer to her leg. She didn't look down at him. She kept her eyes on Garrett, because she had learned long ago that the moment you look away from a man like Garrett is the moment he starts making decisions you haven't consented to. "He needs dry clothes and food," she said. "The rest can wait." It was Dova, the elderly pack healer, who finally moved, crossing the hall with a blanket and the authority of someone who had outlived enough crises to find them boring. She wrapped Sorin without ceremony and shooed Marin toward the hearthside. Sorin went where Marin went. She noticed that. She also noticed he had not spoken a single word. Chapter 4. The Messenger. They came at first light. Four wolves in the livery of Ashvorn Keep, dark cloaks, silver clasps, the mountain pack's sigil on their chests. They did not knock. They pushed the longhouse door open with the casual authority of people who have never needed to knock, and the foremost of them, a tall woman with a shaved head and measuring eyes, looked around the room until she found Marin. She found Marin because Sorin was still sitting beside her at breakfast, methodically eating porridge with the focused intensity of a child who has decided that if the world is chaotic, food is at least reliable. "You pulled him from the river." "Not a question." "Yes." "You are the wolfless woman," someone in the hall had already told them then. Marin met the woman's eyes. "I'm Marin Voss." "Yes." The tall woman studied her for a moment that felt like a calculation. "You will come with us to Ashvorn Keep." Garrett stepped forward from somewhere. She's a ward of this settlement. She's not she is summoned, the woman said, without looking at Garrett, by the Alpha King. The boy's father. The hall went utterly still. Soren set down his spoon and looked up at Marin with those copper eyes, and she saw in them something she recognized. The expression of a child who has learned that adults are about to make decisions about his life, and who is waiting to see whether this particular adult will be any different. She reached down and took his hand. All right, she said. Give me 10 minutes to get my coat. The coat was still damp. She put it on anyway. Chapter 5. Ashvorn Keep the Keep was built into the mountain's face rather than on top of it, as if the mountain had agreed to swallow it partway out of respect. Stone towers rose from carved ridgelines, banners the color of midnight and old iron snapping in the altitude wind. Marin had seen it from the valley all her life, a silhouette she associated with power that existed at a remove, that governed by edict and messenger and cared for the low settlements the way clouds care for the ground beneath them. She had not imagined standing inside it. The Alpha King was not what she had imagined either. His name was Aldric Vane, and he was waiting for them in the Great Hall, a man in his mid-30s, with the kind of stillness that comes either from tremendous self-possession or from grief so deep it has calcified into something that looks like calm. He was tall. He had the same copper eyes as Soren, or rather, Soren had his eyes, which Marin hadn't understood until this moment. He was on his knees before she could say a word. Not to her. To Soren. The Alpha King of the Ashvorn Mountain Packs was on his knees on the stone floor of his great hall with his arms around his son. His face pressed into the child's wet hair. His shoulders shaking with something that the hall's formal acoustics could not contain. Marin stood back. She looked at the banners and the vaulted ceiling and gave the moment the privacy it deserved. When Aldric finally rose, his eyes were red-rimmed and he did not attempt to hide it. He looked at Marin across the hall with an expression she could not immediately catalog. He still won't speak, he said. He hasn't spoken since his mother died, 4 months ago. He was sent to the valley settlement. I was told it was safer, that there were threats to the keep, that it was temporary. His jaw tightened. I was told wrong, on multiple counts. He communicates, Marin said carefully, with his eyes. He's very clear, if you watch closely. Something shifted in Aldric's face. You watched closely. It seemed important to. He was found by a flood. You held him against the current. That's what happened, yes, Aldric looked at her hands at the bandages Dova had wrapped around her palms that morning. He looked at them for a long time. The pack that kept you? He said slowly. They called you Wolfless. They use that word. They do. And yet my son, he said, who has not moved willingly toward anyone in 4 months, is currently holding the hem of your coat. Marin looked down. Soren was indeed gripping a fold of her damp coat in one small fist, the way children hold on to something they intend to keep. She felt something break open in her chest, warm and terrifying. He can let go, she said softly, whenever he's ready. Can you? Aldric asked. It was a strange question, and she did not know how to answer it, so she said nothing. But she felt the warmth in her chest spread until it was difficult to breathe. Chapter 6. What is not said, and what is she was given a room in the keep that was larger than the entire east wing of the longhouse. She was given clean clothes and meals she did not have to earn. She was given, and this was the strangest gift of all, no task. She was not asked to mend or carry or check the eastern levee in the rain. She was simply present, in the way of a guest, and the novelty of it was so disorienting that she spent the first day looking for something broken to fix. She found Soren instead. He was in the lower courtyard, sitting beside the fountain, dropping pebbles into the water and watching the rings expand. She sat beside him without being asked to sit. She dropped a pebble of her own. They sat together for an hour. The rings kept expanding outward and outward until they reached the fountain's edge and disappeared. On the second day, Aldric found her in the library, not because he had been looking, or so he said, with an unconvincing ease, but because he had also come to the library. He sat in the chair across from her reading table with the posture of a man who had forgotten what it felt like to sit without agenda. He was exiled, Aldric said, not quite looking at her. My own advisors, they told me the Valley settlement would protect him while I addressed the challenge to my leadership from the Southern Pax. They told me he was safe. His voice was flat, with the particular flatness of a man who is maintaining control by speaking about devastation the way you speak about weather. The family they placed him with left the Valley a week after he arrived. He was alone. Marin set down her book. He was alone in that settlement for how long? 6 weeks. She thought about the 6 weeks. She thought about a small boy with copper eyes and fine blue wool and silver buttons, alone in a Valley pack that did not know him, waiting for someone to come back. She thought about how well she knew what that waiting felt like. "He's not a ghost," she said, without quite meaning to speak. Aldrich looked at her. "What?" She told him the old Valley saying. "A wolf without a pack is a ghost. A ghost cannot save anyone." She told him she had believed it. She told him she had pulled a king's son from a flood and it had not felt like a ghost's work. Aldrich was quiet for a moment. The fire in the library grate shifted. "Who taught you that you were a ghost?" he asked. "Everyone I grew up with. They were wrong. It was simply stated. Not a consolation or a performance of chivalry, just a correction, delivered the way you'd correct any factual error, with the expectation that she would update her understanding accordingly." She found, to her considerable embarrassment, that her eyes had gone very bright. Aldrich reached across the table and turned her hand over the bandaged one, and held it with a gentleness entirely at odds with the political mythology that surrounded him. He did not squeeze, he simply kept his hand under hers, a warmth beneath the gauze. "Stay," he said. "For Soren, while he adjusts. If you're willing." She looked at their hands. For Soren, she agreed. They both understood that the sentence was doing a great deal of work. Chapter 7. The mark, the mountain, and the thaw, the weeks, became a month, and the month folded into something with no clear name, a season of small domesticities, of trust built in increments like a levee repaired properly this time, stone by stone. Soren spoke his first word on a Tuesday. It was Marin's name, and he said it because she had left the courtyard before he was ready for her to go, and the urgency of stopping her had overridden whatever mechanism inside him had closed speech off. He said it once, clearly, from across the courtyard, "Marin." She stopped. She turned. His face was fiercely, almost aggressively unsurprised, as if he had known he could do it all along, and had simply been waiting for a sufficient reason. She walked back and sat down beside him at the fountain. "I'm here," she said. He nodded. Then he picked up another pebble and handed it to her, and they dropped them in together, and both rings spread outward from the same center and overlapped in the middle before reaching the edge. Aldrich had watched from the upper corridor window. When Marin came inside, she found him in the hallway wearing the expression of a man who has received news he cannot entirely process. "He spoke," Aldrich said. "He did. To you." Yes, the hallway was narrow and suddenly felt narrower. Aldrich stepped closer, not crowding, just closing the distance that had been maintained by a careful, mutual, entirely transparent pretense that this was only about Soren. "The copper cuff," he said. "You could read part of it, just his name. The rest of the inscription is older script. It says, 'The blood that carries the mark chooses its own answer.'" He paused. "The kings mark the marking on the inside of his wrist, beneath the cuff. It's hereditary, passed to the heir. I have it too." He pushed up his sleeve. On the inside of his wrist, in copper-brown skin marking that looked less like ink and more like something the body had decided on its own, was the same symbol that was engraved on Soren's cuff. Marin looked at it for a moment. "What does it choose?" "Traditionally, it's interpreted as choosing the pack's future, the direction the bloodline goes." He paused again, longer, "but there's another interpretation, older, that it chooses the person the marked wolf trusts most completely, that it only becomes legible visible when that person is present." She looked up at him. "It's been invisible for 4 months," he said quietly, "since his mother died. Until the morning after you carried him in from the flood, the silence between them was the kind that has weight. She thought about being wolfless. She thought about the Valley pack and the borrowed lanterns and the eastern levee in the rain. She thought about the old saying that called people like her ghosts. 'I don't have a wolf,' she said. It came out as a caution she needed him to understand what he was doing." "I know." His voice was very steady. "I have enough wolf for a kingdom. I am not looking for more wolf. I am looking at the person who turned her body into a shield for my son without knowing who he was, because he was small and cold and alone, and that was sufficient reason. He exhaled. Who you are to Soren is not a role I'm offering you. It's something he's already decided. I would like to ask you something different. Ask, she said, he asked. She said yes before the sentence was entirely finished, which embarrassed her, and he laughed a genuine one, the kind that breaks loose unexpectedly, the kind she suspected he had not made in 4 months either. Chapter 8. What is worth the southern challenge to Aldrich's leadership was settled before the mountain spring came negotiated, not fought, because Aldrich turned out to be the kind of ruler who preferred the slow, careful architecture of diplomacy to the clean brutality of dominance shows. And Marin discovered this about him the way she was discovering all things about him, gradually, with pleasure. Finding that each new fact confirmed rather than complicated the whole, her place in the keep was formalized not with ceremony but with practicality, because that was how Aldrich did things quietly, completely. Marin was given the title of Keeper of the Inner Court, which sounded grander than it was, but which gave her legitimate standing in all decisions affecting the keep's internal life. Soren had invented the title, haltingly. With 5-year-old diplomatic genius, she keeps things, he had announced at breakfast, with the assurance of someone delivering a verdict. She should be keeper. Aldrich had looked at his son for a long moment and then had the title entered into the keep's formal record. Marin kept the coat. The waterproof coat that wasn't very waterproof she'd had the sense, the morning she left the valley settlement to come to Ashvorn Keep to take it off the hook by the door. It was hers, technically, one of the few things that was. She had it cleaned and mended and hung in her new room, where it occupied the hook by the door in the way of a kept promise. She was not wolfless the way the valley settlement meant it as a deficiency. A lack. A ghost word. She was wolfless the way the mountains understood silence, as a condition that made you listen harder. She had listened hard enough to hear a child's cry beneath a flood. She had listened hard enough to learn the language of copper eyes that said everything without words. The southern packs, once the challenge was resolved and they came to the keep for the treaty signing, sent envoys who made the mistake of referring to Marin the way the old valley saying would have described her. Aldrich corrected them. Once, quietly, with the kind of certainty that does not need volume. He did not do it to protect her. He did it because he was correcting a factual error. She was there. She heard him. She felt something in her chest settle into place with the permanence of a stone in a well-built wall. Epilogue. 1 year later the saying was different now, or, rather, the same words meant something different when she said them, which amounted to the same thing. A wolf without a pack is a ghost. A ghost cannot save anyone. She had told it to Soren on a morning in early summer, in the courtyard by the fountain, because he was 5 now and asking the questions that 5-year-olds ask when they have decided the world requires explaining. He had been told, by children in the visiting Southern Pack's retinue, that Marin was wolfless, and he had come to her with the word in his mouth like a stone he wanted to show her, wanting to understand if it was a wound or just a word. She had told him the saying. He had listened very seriously. Then, but you saved me. I did. He turned this over. So the saying is wrong. The saying, she told him, is what people believe when they haven't met the right ghost yet. He found this extremely satisfying. He picked up a pebble from the fountain's edge and handed it to her their ritual, unchanged, and they dropped them together. 2 rings from one center, spreading out and out until they found the fountain's edge and went on in invisible ripples beyond what could be seen. Aldrich came into the courtyard the way he always came into whatever space she occupied, not announcing himself, just arriving, because after a year he seemed to feel that her spaces were partially his, and he was right. He had Soren's old copper cuff in his hand. Soren had graduated, recently, from the child's cuff to the formal bracelet of the Ashvorn heir, larger, heavier, the inscription reproduced in full. He'd surrendered the child cuff to his father with ceremony, because Soren understood ceremony when it was real. Aldrich had given it to Marin. Not the full bracelet that was Soren's birthright and would stay on Soren's wrist until the day he passed it on. But the child cuff, the small copper thing she had read by lantern light in floodwater. The first word of the whole story. Soren. She wore it on a cord around her neck. She wore it now. He sat down beside her at the fountain and looked at the cub, who had acquired another pebble and was studying its aerodynamic properties with scientific interest. He asked me this morning, Aldrich said quietly, if ghosts can be mothers. Marin looked at him. His copper eyes held the same light as his son's, that inner warmth she had first seen in Floodwater and had not stopped finding, no matter how many times she looked. What did you tell him? I told him the best ones can. He reached over and closed his hand gently around the copper cuff at her neck. I told him the best ones already are. The river in the valley below ran clean and contained in its proper banks. The mountain spring was warm this year. The courtyard fountain caught the sunlight and threw it back in rings, outward and outward, touching everything. A ghost cannot save anyone, the valley had said. But a woman who listened hard enough to hear a child through a flood, who turned her body into a wall between a small, cold life and a river that wanted it, that woman had saved a boy, and a king, and herself, in approximately that order. And the copper cuff against her sternum was warm from her skin, and she pressed her palm to it and felt its weight, and knew without needing anyone to tell her, she had never been a ghost. She had only ever been early. End.